We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. Tonight's show, we start with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone, A Boy and His Dog. Then I interview Rachel Kovac, who has a well-reviewed book out called Disharmony, a jigsaw collection of misguided dating. And then music by George Serra. He just released an album called Vicissitudes. You'll love his music. Stay tuned.
$6.99 Pasta Leon Avenue, Atlanta, Georgia, was not the place most boys wanted to be in 1967. $6.99 Ponce was a nondescript, grimy brick structure, three stories tall. Its exterior was in need of a good cleaning. It looked gloomy. The building to the immediate east of $6.99 Ponce was the Sears Roebuck Building. There was a train trestle that separated 699 from the Sears building. The world-famous Claremont Lounge, 789 Ponce, was less than 100 yards to the east. The Claremont was literally in the next block from 699 Ponce. 699 Ponce de Leon was the military entrance processing station. Every day in the 60s, buses would pull up to the MEPS and unload scores of scared teenage boys from all over Georgia for their pre-induction physical. There was a war going on in Vietnam. The draft boards of Georgia needed to know who was physically able to go to war. The pre-induction physical was comprised of a series of tests, the first being the IQ test. Tough questions like, what color is the sky? Tough to flunk out of that IQ test. The bar was low. If you made it through that tough mental grilling, the pre-induction candidates were then directed to a huge locker room and given a paper shopping bag. They were instructed to strip to their underwear and leave on their shoes and socks. Put their remaining clothes into the shopping bag. If you had any documents that would get you out of the draft, you carried those with you as well. Several hundred boys in their underwear were herded into a room to be interviewed by a small group of doctors. Boys with terrible eyesight, heart murmurs, deformed limbs, obesity or frailty, or asthma were excused immediately. Others had doctors' letters that stated why they should not be considered for service. Bedwetting and indigestion were common excuses. Some were excused, some were not. There were some that did not want to be drafted and went to great lengths to make sure that didn't happen. Some didn't bathe for weeks, didn't eat anything, lived on diet pills, amphetamines for the days before their pre-induction physical. They were the speed freaks of the day. I knew one guy that shot himself in the foot with a .22 rifle. Some were excused, some were not. Those left in line completed a physical, weight, height, blood draw, eye and hearing exam, reflexes, hernia, blood pressure, anal exam, pulse rate, turn your head left and cough was one of the more memorable parts of the physical. Once you were declared physically fit to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces, you were then given a list of subversive organizations and asked if you had ever been a member of any of the organizations. It was 1967. The U.S. had almost 500,000 soldiers fighting in Vietnam. That number was up from 300,000 in 1965. The war was raging. Sadly, U.S. soldiers were being killed and wounded, lots of them. In the eyes of the law, my friend Dirk, who was 18, was not an adult. He could not enter into a binding contract. He could not vote. He could not even buy a six-pack of beer at the liquor store. He was old enough to be drafted into the armed forces and fight for his country and possibly be wounded or worse, God forbid. Dirk joined the Air Force. He performed his basic training at Lakeland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. Quote, after basic, I had to report to the AZR training, the Combat Preparedness Course training at Lackland for 6 weeks. This was the combat training in conditions that ranged from being very hot and humid and extremely wet. We were taught guerrilla warfare and tactical training skills needed to survive in Vietnam. Most AZR training was at night. I was vaccinated for typhoid, tetanus, malaria, measles, smallpox, and diphtheria. My arm was sore for a week. When I joined the Air Force, I thought it would be less dangerous than being assigned to the Army. Little did I know. Dirk was assigned to be in the Canine Corps after basic and AZR training. In the winter of 1967, Dirk met his new best friend, Cam, a one-year-old German Shepherd. Cam was already trained when Dirk got there. It was Dirk that needed to be trained. He had to meld into a single fighting unit with Cam. When I got there, it was freezing cold. We were not allowed to wear gloves, so our hands were exposed and raw from the weather. Cam had the benefit of a nice, thick fur coat. Dirk didn't. There is a common misconception that dog's eyesight is not that good. A dog's eyesight is actually better than human eyesight at dusk and dawn. It is the dog's sense of smell and hearing that make them perfect to be a military working dog. A dog's sense of smell can be 1,000 to 10 million times more sensitive than a human's, depending on the breed. The part of the dog's brain that controls smell is 40 times larger than it is in humans. A dog's distant hearing is 4 times that of a human being. Dogs with perked ears, German Shepherds, can hear best. They have 18 muscles allowing them to move their ears to hear better. Cam could hear and smell a mouse fart at 100 yards. If that mouse twitched his tail, Cam could see him too. Cam scored a 99 on our last exam. It had been a tough few months for Dirk. Dirk and his dog Cam were a sentry dog team for the PACAF, the Pacific Air Force Bomb Group. One dog and one handler worked at night. Their mission was to detect, detain, and destroy. They guarded the perimeter of their base. They were the first line of defense for the base. According to Dirk, so much for the Air Force being less dangerous than being in the Army. Me and Cam hit all the hot spots in Vietnam, Tansanut, Phang Rang, Da Nang, Phu Cat. All of the canines and their handlers were hauled to our nightly post in a deuce and a half, a 2.5-ton cargo truck. The dogs were muzzled and sat on the floor between the knees of their handlers. The only humans that the dogs ever interacted with were their handlers and the veterinarian that took care of their health issues. The dogs were always muzzled when they went to the vet. Cam weighed 120 pounds, and there was not an ounce of fat on him. He was a handsome dog, beautiful markings. He was an awesome animal and my best friend. I loved him. He knew it and was willing to die for me. If I went down, Cam would cover me like a blanket and not move. Cam was smart as well. He saved my ass numeral times. I was nothing without him. Cam was fearless. He would charge a machine gun nest. Cam was not afraid of the sound of gunfire or mortar explosions. He was trained not to fear these sounds at Lackland Air Force Base. The dog spent 3 weeks having M-80s, cherry bombs, and rolls of Black Cat firecrackers exploded near them. After 3 weeks of that around-the-clock sound assault, Cam could sleep through it. The dogs that could not handle the noise were washed out. Like all military dogs, Cam had a serial number tattooed inside his left ear. Cam never had a traditional family. He was a military working dog. He was 100% military. He lived and died with no dog parks. He got no treats. His idea of a good time was to run the obstacle course. All he wanted was praise from Dirk. When Cam ran the obstacle course, Dirk ran it with him. As a result, both were very fit. Other than that, Cam was 100% business. Dirk said, quote, "When Cam alerted, he was never wrong." If you look between Cam's ears and down his nose, it was like looking down the sight of a rifle. Releasing your dog was the same thing as firing your weapon. But releasing your dog was the last thing you wanted to do as a dog handler. When Cam and I were on patrol, we were quiet. Our job was detection. Our job was to notify the tower that Cam had alerted to something. I carried 2 canteens full of water because we did not want the sound of water sloshing around, letting Charlie know we were coming. We were like ghosts until we weren't. I carried a modified M16 with 4 additional 30-round clips, 3 slap flares, and a red-lensed angled flashlight all on a web belt. Cam did not have anything but a choke chain around his neck. No collar, no halter. I was right by his side with a 36-inch leash. When Cam was on patrol, he was very alert, very watchful. He didn't miss anything. When he alerted, his pace slowed and stopped. He lowered his body. His ears moved toward the intruder. His nose flared. He would not make a sound. No bark, no whimper. I would slip his choke chain off his neck. Taking his choke chain off was like me releasing the safety on my M16. Cam would not attack unless I gave him the command. That was not our job. If Cam did have to attack, there was nothing for Charlie to hang on to while Cam chewed his ass. Charlie was scared to death of Cam. The last thing Charlie wanted to hear was, "Get him, Cam." It was the last thing that several VC ever heard. Cam went for the throat like a tiger or a lion. He might bite an arm that got in the way, but his target was always the throat. He was ridiculously fast at getting to the throat. Our job was to detect, detain, and destroy. Detection was job number one. Cam often left out the middle part. Once Cam detected and was released, he often destroyed before I could call him off to detain. Occasionally, I was a little slow on calling Cam off, particularly if Charlie had shot at us. When you went through the crazy things we went through, your heart gets hard and cold. Dirk was shot in the hand one night. Destroy was not our mission. We called in the Marines for that. Occasionally, Charlie was not in the mood to wait for the Marines to arrive. That's when Cam got released. There were 10,000 handlers in the K-9 Corps and nearly 5,000 dogs. Most military working dogs had multiple deployments. That meant after the handler completed his tour of duty and rotated back stateside, the dog had to be retrained with a new handler. Just like at Lackland, it was the new handler that had to be trained. Drill instructors were happy to tell the new handler trainees how dumb they were compared to the dogs. The dogs knew what to do. The handlers had to be trained. For the military, the dogs were like a piece of equipment, like a Jeep or a rifle. Dirk made it back stateside, married his high school sweetheart, got a job in civil service, and worked for 25 years.
This is Mystic Pete. I have Rachel Kovac in studio. It's April 26, 2021. Rachel has a book out called Disharmony, a Jigsaw Collection of Misguided Dating. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Pete. How are you?
So glad to have you in studio today. This book is starting to blow up, and I wanted to get you on KXLU and let our listeners know about your wonderful creation. Why don't you speak a little about what this is all about?
So my book is a alphabetical collection of my awful dating life. So essentially, I was woke up one day in my Los Angeles apartment and after a bad date and realized I'm like, I cannot be the only person. So I went to Republic of Pie in North Hollywood and I was just jotting down some notes and making myself laugh alone in this little coffee shop. And I realized that all of my lessons were alphabetical. Like somehow my organizational brain put all my lessons into this alphabet. And I just started writing them down. And I took my journey from my teen years all the way to 30 and just started writing down the good, bad, and the ugly. And as I was writing, I found that dating is so often like redirected to trying to find your perfect person and not realizing that you're your perfect person first. And so it became this story of self-growth and empowerment, and it's really taken off. I'm just very grateful that my bad luck has brought so much to so many people.
Well, I think it's your authentic voice and your real confiding of yourself that people are responding to. I read it from cover to cover. It's well written. It's accessible. It's funny. It's tragic at times. And we want to hear about people's real stories.
And that is the truth. I think that's, you know, releasing a book in the middle of a pandemic was a big gamble. Just because, you know, you didn't have your traditional book signings or local book events or even international like I had been pitched. They had been like, oh, yeah, we'll send your book here. And they couldn't because the world was frozen. And so just trying to wait and see, like, okay, who's going to hear this story? Like, who will, did I just publish some very intimate details of myself for no one but myself and my judgy mother? You know, I was like, Oh man, what's going on? Yeah. And, you know, fortunately, people who do read the book, they are able to connect. And they're seeing that not only have they made similar mistakes as me, but there's some understanding that, okay, I'm not alone. And it becomes this new message of that we need to revamp dating culture. It does not need to be the toxic wasteland it's become.
Well, this was written before the pandemic, and it was already hard finding a mate and finding intimacy. And the pandemic just made things much more complicated. We're finally coming out of it, but perhaps we'll come out with a reassessment and new ideas about how to approach people and connect.
Or we're just going to get used to that cabin fever brain and everyone's going to be like, 6 feet, high five, let's have sex.
Ah, okay. Sign me up. Well, you brought up a term that I wanted to express. Well, I have strong feelings about this term and I just wanted to see what you thought about it. And that's soulmate. And there's a lot of seminars and books and so forth about soulmates. And to me, I never really liked this idea. I never liked the idea of how to find your soulmate or looking for your soulmate. Soulmate to me is something, you're 85 years old, you're sitting at the beach with your spouse who you've been with for decades, and you look at each other and go, oh, you're my soulmate. In other words, it's something you look at and you figure out retrospectively, not like you can go about finding it intentionally. So that whole idea, that whole process seems so contrived and forced. Oh, let's go find my soulmate. Come on, guys. Anyway, what do you think about that?
Yeah.
You can disagree.
You know, it's very interesting. is being a product of true love, like I am, unfortunately. So I am very fortunate that I'm come from marriages that not only were long lasting, but full of love. My father's parents have been married for over 65 years. My mother's parents, before they died, they were together over 65 years. And my own parents have been married for over 35. It's been a very, you know, for me growing up, seeing these marriages, it was like, oh, you find that person and that's your soulmate. That's true love and all these things. And, you know, as I grew into a person and I'm going out to date young and Disney fairy tale eyed, looking for charming and realizing that 18-year-old guys don't do that. 27-year-old guys don't do that. 45-year-old guys don't do that. And I'm like, oh, what happened? My promise had been gone and all this stuff. And so now being, you know, older than both, really all three of the relationships I had mentioned and not married and not doing this, there is a pressure in the sense of failure that comes that like, oh, that didn't happen for you. Oh man, you know, look at what happened. Where did you mess up? And I think you're right that there is this like, you know, you think that you're going to find your soulmate. But then when you realize that they were only soulmates with each other because they were settled in themselves, They were confident in themselves and their relationship, even through the good and the bad times, ultimately you're your own soulmate. And anyone there is supposed to be a compatible piece to make your life more fulfilling as long as we're living in it.
I love what you're saying. And to me, it's like approaching love and marriage as an altar. In other words, you find someone, and instead of hoping they're the perfect collection of characteristics that you can love, you love the person that's with you. Like, they become the object of your devotion. And if you go back 150 years and prior, marriage was, you may have met your spouse on the day you got married. You went to a town, And that's somebody chose it for you, and that's it. And you found love with that. Maybe you didn't, but certainly a lot of people, that's my person, and I'm going to learn to love them and be devoted to them and cherish them. That's it. So clearly, people have that capacity to devote themselves and find love with whoever they're with. And I think that's getting lost in this day and age. We want some perfect creation that, you know, this prince or princess that it smells sweet and is the perfect match for us. No, you love them. You find love with the partner you're with. And I'm not recommending that we go back to the times when we had prearranged marriages. I'm just saying that, you know, we have to really bring that to the person we choose. If you choose them, you go all in, you overlook their faults, and you build them up. You know, that's what you do, and you create a good relationship with them.
Well, I think that you touched upon something that is such a critical error in modern dating right now, is that people are trying to get married for their beautiful wedding and their beautiful party. They're like, oh my God, I cannot wait for these wedding photos. I can't wait for my Instagram wedding moment. I can't tell you how many times on a feed I see the same bridesmaid pose, the same rings, the same look, and I can't even remember who the couple is because it's just blended into this noise of like, illustrated happiness. Like, they're just like, oh, I am so happy I'm here. Yet, within 6 months of them actually being married and understanding that in this committed relationship, there is sacrifice, there is humility, There is communication, there is compromise, they're unable to do so. And why would they have to when they already got the party and they got the presents and they got the house and the dog and whatever part of that picture is there? And so you really see in this, you know, then unfortunately with social media being as tempting as it is, you've got the dating apps that provide an outlet to looking elsewhere. And something that is literally in the privacy of your home, in your marriage, on your literal phone, is an invitation to stray or at least get distracted. And so then the couple breaks apart and the cycle of dating restarts. And this will keep going with this acceleration on our dependence on these outlets.
So it's like this image of happiness people are chasing, or this branding, or it's out of desperation.
Oh, yeah. I don't know about you, but this is definitely the fun, cynical part of me. When I see the couples create wedding hashtags, I just yak. Like, I'm like, oh, no. And yet they get it all over for their wedding and all these cute little blended phrases. And you're just like, okay, that's what you wanted. You don't necessarily want to be with this person. You just wanted the cutesy hashtag that we can all buy into. And so I think that there's definitely some... there's a new air of caution that we have to have because people are being so superficial when it comes to dating. They want to get those check marks met. And I'm not saying this is everybody. I'm just saying that this is something that is definitely being seen in current dating culture.
I'm talking with Rachel Kovac, who has a book that's just blowing up right now called Disharmony, a Jigsaw Collection of Misguided Dating. And you're approaching this as love really is a relationship with yourself and resolving yourself and finding your own inner Cupid, inner muse. And then love comes from that. And I added to it perhaps that of seeing relationships as a temple you come to bring your devotion to, instead of this like image of happiness or wanting to find perfection and completion in your other half.
Absolutely. I think that that is something that, you know, when done right, relationships are this mutual love and this generous giving that helps both parties grow. And if it's not, if it's a one-way devotional, it doesn't work.
I understand you're working on another book now, a piece of fiction?
Yes. So aiming to be released by the end of this year, we are going to be following the story called Launch, which follows a woman's path into understanding and identifying the importance of slowing down and embracing the value of relationships. So I won't give much more away, but it's going to be a very fun ride.
People can find you at rrkovac.com. That's K-O-V-A-C-H.
That's correct.
Have you been dating at all since the book came out? And to what effect?
So dating has been very interesting since the book has been released. You know, writing a book about failed dating is not really good dating bait for others. I did not realize. But, you know, when I have gone out with people, it's been very interesting. The new post-COVID culture, you have to be even more cautious when you go out because not only are you worried about where you've been and where he's been, but now you're worrying about perspectives or opinions. And I think the most humorous part with the dates I've been on since this book has been released, there's always like 15 minutes of, hey, you get your vaccine. Which one did you get? Do you believe in it? And you're like, okay, now that I got this, now that you get this obligatory political stamp on it, then you can actually learn about the other person. But it's been pretty funny. No luck with Cupid just yet, but there's always hope. I'm still a very proud dog parent.
So dating is devolved into vaccine protocol.
Oh, yes.
You know, frankly, I feel like a lot of people's social skills have degraded. And I think also the app culture makes it even more difficult to date because you're choosing people based on this 2-inch by 2-inch picture of themselves. And it's the most kind of superficial veneer of character. So that's what people are choosing based on. And I mean, how does that lead to good, deep heart connection?
It isn't. And it's very fascinating when you sit there and you realize you are making a judgment. Like, are you worth a whiskey? Essentially, like, am I looking at this 2x2 photo and thinking you're worth a old fashioned to me, or you're worth this? Like, is this worth meeting with you? And there are some that you send the wave or the approval and they come back with an eggplant emoji and you go, wow, we've really devolved to not even having words, just emojis to tell me that you want to get laid. And you're just like, wow, like, okay, moving on, because I love myself more than an emoji. Maybe three. I'm just kidding. But no, it's just that it's very different how, you know, social skills are out the window. And definitely you got, I'm waiting for the COVID card parties where you won't be let in until you show your vaccine card. You know, all those hot celebrities now are doing that.
That's amazing. Wow. It's complicated. And then you've also indicated another problem. It's like a lot of guys are addicted to porno or just watching a lot of porno, and it, I think, distorts their idea of dating and women and what women want and expect. Yeah, texting an eggplant emoji, like, right up front. It's just like such a kind of perversion of dating and getting to know each other and finding intimacy. It's just like right to this physical act. And if you watch a lot of that stuff, you want it to be very intense and weird and edgy. And that may have nothing to do with finding a partner and caring.
Yeah. And what's crazy is if you look at the statistics of modern pornography, women are actually the top consumer of viewing it. Women watch pornography much higher rates than men. And the fact is, even though they're watching and they're just like, they'll verbally go, oh, that's degrading, they're still viewing it. They're still looking at you like, oh, okay. And as a woman, you have to ask yourself, like, okay, there's the old argument like that's someone's daughter no longer works. I think this modern culture has zero empathy for that argument anymore. They're kind of like, oh, that's hot, which is disgusting. But I think that now we have to ask ourselves, you know, what are we putting in our heads? What expectations are we setting? And then with this falsified glamour, sometimes glamorous, sometimes hideous depiction of recorded sex, now we have these false expectations and then we can't have functional, normal, typical relationships. So there's just problems across the board with that. And definitely if you're getting an emoji sliding into your DMs, that's definitely a red flag.
Well, I didn't know that women are watching so much porno. I'd be curious to know what types of porno women generally trend towards. But that indicates to me that women, not only men, but actually women also have sexual desire? Is that the way it is?
What? No way. Yes. Of course women have sexual desire and curiosity and wanting to know. And even though, especially when the realm of pornography came out as like, oh, men are perverts, we all have this desire to view, learn, adapt through observational learning. Women, we just kept it on the down low longer. And it's only now that we're revealing, oh yeah, no, I do that.
Interesting. Tell me how writing this book has changed you. Like, stepping back a second, what has this done in your life and to your spirit, and now seeing the world validate you in a big way? Tell me about that journey.
You know, I'm very fortunate. I'm the daughter of a published author. So for me, growing up, writing was essential to identify your voice, to be a therapy, to convey your emotion. But I hadn't done it in a long time. Like, of course I did what I needed to for school to accomplish my degrees, but to actually write for myself in therapy, that hadn't been for a long time. Going through the disharmony process, I had originally thought, oh, I'll finish this out in 2 months. Like, it's not that bad. That actually took almost 4 years for me to, like, face the brutal truth that not only were some dates worse than I remembered, but also, you know, I sabotaged my own happiness for a long time. And there were a lot of things I wasn't prepared to face. There were a lot of losses that weren't even romantic. They were just life losses that fragmented me and made me less of a able dater. And so perfectly great guys that could have been in my path, could have been in my life, I wasn't prepared for. And so writing this book and going through that, it really did give me the sense of ownership of my love life. And the sense to be like, you know, it's very easy to point the finger at others and be like, you're the reason I'm unhappy. But once you realize your own fault and you go, oh, wait, man, I should have done this. You really start loving yourself for the whole picture. And now, you know, now that this book is out, now that my truth is out there, you know, I feel way more capable as a dater because there's nothing to hide from. There are no secrets. It's there. Like, you can find it on page 47 or whatever it is. And so it was a very empowering and liberating experience. The praise is just so humbling. I'm so grateful to the attention it's gotten. But even more than that, I'm so grateful for the lives it's helped. And men and women alike who come to me and tell me, oh, I've been this guy, I've been this girl, oh, I can completely relate to this. It really, for me, now stands as we as a society are turning a corner and revising how we date and seeing, you know, hey, I gotta love me too. And I gotta love me first before you're ready to partner up with someone and share a life together.
We're going to hear a selection from your book in a minute. Any final words you'd like to leave the listeners with?
You know, love is so special. It's something that kind of is that compass for all of us. But the secret to making that compass guide you to where you need to be is you need to be solid in your own heart and in your own mind. And once you love yourself, navigating you to that right person is going to be exactly what you need to do next. So, wishing you all the best in life and love.
Good advice. Rachel Kovach, Kovach at rrkovach.com, with the book out called Disharmony, a Jigsaw Collection of Misguided Dating. Thank you so much for your time today. Very well spoken. Your book is really revealing, and you're vulnerable and you're confiding in us, and appreciate what you've created. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Pete, for having me. This is Rachel Kovach, author of Disharmony, a Jigsaw Collection of Misguided Dating. And for your listening pleasure, you are getting a sneak peek into the chapter Untouchable. Mirror, mirror on the wall, what is it about me that makes me untouchable? Is it my face? Oh, this too round face. Double and triple chins can be seen at all angles. Oh Lord, how is my eyeliner so uneven? One eye looks almond-shaped, the other round. Is it this nose? Oh, this pushed-in nose I have. I wish I could have belonged to wolf-like people, those with perfectly angled faces and defined features. Instead, I resemble my grandparents' obese senior King Charles Cavalier, her breathing and waddle heard before ever seeing her come down the walkway. Is it the fact that my skin isn't warm in tone? One glance in the sun's direction changes its form from pasty white to painful red. Who wants to touch a cherry tomato when you can caress sensual suede? Oh, mirror, mirror, maybe it isn't my face at all. Do I smell? Am I so nose blind that I haven't caught the scent I give off of repulsion and disgust? Body odor burning the nostrils of humanity and creatures countywide? No, that can't be it. My chronic need to shower twice a day keeps that element in check. If it isn't my face, If it isn't my scent, is it my voice? Oh God, is it my voice? Some have told me I sound like Drew Barrymore. I've always taken it as a compliment. Am I misguided? Has it been a societal warning that this lisp and Californian accent are keeping all away from me? Is my voice not one of a sensual mermaid luring lovers to the shore for passion-led destruction, but instead an awkward broken-winged seagull choking on the cap of a water bottle, screeching and flapping around in hysteric distress? Oh God, this horrible voice. No, no, magic mirror. That can't be the reason why I'm untouchable. Maybe I've broken a cardinal rule of love in this or another life. Maybe I betrayed my lover in a coven of witches and warlocks and have come cursed to live a life of solitude and unanswered prayers in this one. Maybe it has nothing to do with a past life at all. Maybe I got cursed in this life. I can only think of one time I was intentionally rude to a boy at school. I hung out with the wrong crowd for a time in elementary, learned false information from friends about what sex was, would laugh at them when we talked about boys and girls doing that to one another. Ew, why would they put that there? I'd ask naively. Then there was a boy, an awkward, annoying boy. He liked my friend. She didn't like him, didn't like him. I wanted her to think I was cool like her. So I forged a misspelled awkward note. A note requesting sex from one student to another in third grade. Oh, I thought nothing of the consequences. No, this would keep us laughing for such a long time. That is, until I got called into the principal's office. My mother's angry glare assaulting my senses when I entered the room. I got caught due to my inability to spell correctly. Damn my dyslexia. My consequences were fair. 2 weeks detention, a public apology to my class for lying and starting rumors, 2 weekends in a row in my room with no television or privileges. But maybe, magic mirror, those weren't my only consequences. Maybe, because of my foolishness, God decided that wasn't a complete punishment. Maybe because I wronged this awkward boy for no reason other than to be cool, he took away my chance at love in the future. Maybe he built someone so special, so wonderful, so fulfilling for me, then my desperate attempt at popularity changed my destiny. Yes, maybe I am untouchable because I made someone else untouchable. So young and so dumb in the third grade I was. How could I have known my choice would destroy my future? Oh, mirror, mirror, have I found it? Is this the answer? Am I suffering third grade consequences at 30? No. 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 Mirror, mirror, please show me what I am missing. I don't know why I am not someone men want to touch. It has been so long, so painfully long since I have been wanted, desired, needed. Mirror, mirror, tell me what to say, what to do, what to be, to connect with someone else, to be lovable, to be touchable. Damn you, magic mirror, for you can't respond to me. I can only hear myself, caught in a trap of confusion and doubt, my reflection not only the question, but the answer.
This is Mystic Pete. It is May 1st, 2021. I have George Serra on the phone, longtime KXLU favorite. Had him on my show a lot of times, played a lot of his music, big personal fan. And he just came out with an album called Vicissitudes, music for two films that he scored. Hi, George Serra.
Hi, Mystic Pete.
One film is called Passion of Joan of Arc, which has been... the film itself is incredible, from 1928. And then you have this extraordinary score on top, and it's received all kinds of wonderful reviews. And then this other film, Her Name Was Joe. I'll let you talk.
Okay. So the Joan of Arc, I was commissioned several years ago by Grand Performances to write an original score to perform it live, and which I did. And then after that concert, I started getting requests from other film festivals and performing arts centers and museums to perform it around the country. And I was doing that actually prior to lockdown. I was in Toronto and Milwaukee and Dallas and stuff. I also scored a film of original music, a new movie, not an old one. Her Name is Joe, which was just released this past April. And it's available on all, like, you know, digital format, Amazon Prime, iTunes, wherever, you know, people would go to rent a movie now digitally. It's available. And that's an original score. And for that, I actually put together a quartet of musicians, guitarist, drummer, vocalist. And I would say the soundtrack is more Americana. I used a lot of acoustic guitar, you know, something that I normally don't do. So it was a bit of a stretch for me personally. But yeah, it was a lot of fun to work on both projects. I got a lot of creative freedom on both projects. And I wanted to release a new album this year since everyone was in lockdown. And since the film's available, I wanted to at least have something that people can listen to in case they saw the movie.
And you're looking forward to touring pretty soon?
Yeah, I mean, once things open back up, I'm not sure how that's going to, what that's going to look like, obviously. But yeah.
Because of the plague thing and we all don't want to die from some horrific disease?
Yeah, that thing, yeah. Yeah.
I knew it was something like that.
Yeah, so, I had shows booked in Tucson and San Francisco that's got postponed, and I just don't know what's happening with that. I have not heard from these folks. I think, you know, they're probably, you know, concerned about, you know, other stuff, right? You know, like how they're gonna stay open, and yeah, so.
All right, so the album is called Vicissitudes, and this is music by George Serra. It's spelled like George, like George Washington or George of the Jungle. And Serra, S-A-R-A.
Yeah, S-A-R-A-H, sorry. Yes.
Okay. I'm losing it. One too many beers tonight, George Serra.
It's all good.
So,
yeah.
Listeners, this is a really brilliant album. It's beautiful. And I think George Serra should get popular now. We do not want posthumous fame. Not this lifetime. We've done that. We know what that's like. We want while he's human.
Exactly.
We're going to hear the first track, track number one, which is called
Saint Catherine.
Saint Catherine is from Passion of Joan of Arc score.
Yes.
And then we'll go on and hear a few other tunes.
Okay, sounds good.
Any last words, George Serra?
Yeah, you can find me on Facebook, George Serra Music, also Bandcamp. If you want to get an actual physical CD, Bandcamp is the best place. But it's also available on Amazon and those places too. And you can also digitally download it at wherever you go to get digital downloads, like iTunes and stuff. So, yeah, George Serra, Vicissitudes. It's kind of a tongue twister, but
say it three times fast.
I don't think.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, Mystic.
We hope this one's the big one.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh,
Coming to the end of a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com or I'm Mystic Pete on social media. We started the show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called A Boy and His Dog. Then I interviewed Rachel Kovac about her book Disharmony, a jigsaw collection of misguided dating. And then music by George Serra from his incredible album called Vicissitudes. Thanks so much for listening. Mystic Pete out.